podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
If you run a business, Bank of Clark County has you covered. Offering cash management services to automate and simplify your business banking, streamlined digital banking, and merchant payment processing that's a one-stop solution. Plus, Bank of Clark offers corporate credit cards that help you optimize capital, organize expenses, and enhance your business. Whether you're looking to earn points faster or lower your APR, Bank of Clark County has the card that's right for you. Member FDIC.
Mirror name, you twist and turn my mind until I don't know who I am. Mirror name.
Good morning and welcome to a new edition of the Arsenal Opinion Podcast. It's not on the whistle. I'm calling it the big roundup because we've got no games to talk about. We've got nothing to preview because the Spurs game is out the door. So Matt, I'm going to go straight to you. Firstly, to find out how you're doing. And secondly, where do we even start with a hot take? Because there's so much going on this week.
So much to go on. I think we've all just been desperate to pod and get together and share everything we've been thinking. It's been another eventful week in the world of Arsenal. The Liverpool game and then everything really focused on the North London derby. And, you know, once the dust had settled over after the Liverpool game, we were all very concerned about how we were going to put together a team and risk getting beat in a really important six-pointer. We prayed for a postponement. We didn't really believe we'd get it with one COVID case. But, you know, we managed to. And I'm delighted. Even more delighted because it feels like we're beginning to shed this victim culture that's been around the club for over a decade. You know, this sense that things just happen to us and often they're not fair. And it stinks, victim culture, in my opinion. And I think we saw the Tottenham statement that just came out. They look like victims. They sound pathetic. And I think what we're now saying is we accept that life isn't fair. We're going to make things work for us. We made the system work for us. We got the postponement. We'll get players back. And then we're going to go back to the lane with our full team. And we're hopefully going to absolutely batter them.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of a hot take. So we're going to go into it. My hot take today is it feels like this is the week that Arsenal grew up on many levels. Arsenal didn't get anything from the league when we lost five players to COVID. On the Brentford game, we found out the day before that the players had COVID. Players couldn't even go on the team bus because they could, yeah, didn't know who was suffering and who wasn't suffering. And we lost that game. That led to the Chelsea game being a bit of a joke, and then that led to the Man City game. So we started the season heading into the first international break with 0 points, and the narrative wasn't unlucky Arsenal for getting butchered by COVID and all of those injuries. It was Arteta out. It was Arteta out from a big chunk of the fan base. The pundits were saying that he wasn't up to the job. And then we get a few months in and then teams are getting games cancelled left, right and centre. And my big thing from the start of the season was, where is our leadership team in moments like that? You know, would you do that to Man United? Would you do that to Chelsea? Would you do that to Liverpool and Klopp? And it just felt like Arsenal were always the unlucky ones, the case study and what not to do. But this week, on many levels, we've grown up. Firstly, you've got to say Richard Garlick's done a fantastic job getting that game called up. And we'll get into how the Spurs cancellation came about. We were talking a little bit before the game that, a bit of corporate genius going on there, in my opinion. But then we've got to talk about the Liverpool game as well. Going down to 10 men. Against one of the best teams in the world, even without two of their star players. We had a bit of COVID in the squad. We had some real second stringers, had a fourth choice right back who you'd expect to be out the door, but he's not. And what a performance. What a performance. Everybody grew up. Everybody put in a shift. No one felt sorry for themselves. And, you know, arguably the two best performances of the season have been a game that we drew and a game that we lost. So I feel like we're in really good shape. You got anything to add on that, Matt?
Well, we could get into the Liverpool game. I mean, you're right. I mean, a few people from fans of other teams have been sending me messages laughing a little bit and going, oh, you guys are hilarious. You know, you think you're back, but so far you lost to City, you lost to Forest, and you drew with Liverpool. You've had two men sent off, and you're talking like you're back. It's hilarious. It just shows how low the standards are at Arsenal, and that has been leveled. But I think that, and we often talk about it, it's the eye test versus the stats test, and the eye test tell us that something significant is happening, that we're evolving as a team, that we're on the right track. So I don't think any of us are too bothered about those results not going our way, because we see the path forward to where we need to get to. But I also think that's why it's important that the Spurs game was called off, because eventually, if you have too many statistics going against you, even if there's a very good, valid reason behind it, you can end up losing confidence in some way. So a lot of positivity. I feel the other sort of metric of whether things are improving and whether we're getting back to where we should be is fan engagement. I feel like over the course of the last, on a bigger level, over the course of the last 10 years, but specifically over the course of the last 3 years, it feels like there's been a lack of engagement, a lack of connection between fans and players. And I think that, and it's all credit to the management, to the team, to the club as a whole. I think some of those Highlanders as well have really made a difference. But for the first time, there just seems to be such a strong connection between the fans and the players, and the level of engagement around it. I feel like I was watching that Liverpool game and I felt like I was kicking every ball with them. And it hasn't felt like that for periods of time. So that Liverpool game was really, really something special. And if this team go on to be successful over the next 5 years, I wonder whether we'll look back at that game as one of the examples where we began to demonstrate that the evolution was really going somewhere.
Yeah, I agree with all that, Matt. I agree with all that, Matt. And I think there are so many things to get into and so much detail that we want to get under the skin of that we're just going to jump in. So I want to jump in to the Spurs cancellation. I love it when Arsenal fans get together. It's just all about victimhood. Poor us, the media bias, COVID conspiring against us, injuries. Feels like old times. It feels like old times. And I got to say, I wrote a blog this morning. I got up and I thought there was absolutely no chance that Spurs game was getting cancelled. I thought that we were going to be rolling out with the most makeshift of midfield. I thought that we had a chance, because I think the Spurs have been very drossy this season. But Antonio Conte is a very experienced manager, and Spurs have still got good players, and it would have been tough. I saw the press the presser that went out yesterday, and I saw Arsenal cite AFCON injuries and COVID, and I thought, oh, it's game over. It's like Arsenal were just trying this. It's like putting in Spurs trying to sign Rivaldo back in the day. It's just theatre. There was no chance. And then all of a sudden, David Ornstein pops up and says that it's cancelled. What do you think went on here, Matt? What do you think went on? How did Arsenal manage to pull this out of the bag? Because most people are saying we didn't have enough COVID cases. We only have one. What happened here?
I mean, I think that one of the things that we've been guilty of is, and we talk about it a bit, which is being masters of the dark arts. And it's something that, you know, we are the complete antithesis of that. We're hopelessly naive a lot of the time when it comes to this sort of stuff. But I think that we got our lawyers involved. I don't know any of the details, but it felt like there are certain precedents that took place that allowed us to build a case. I think that overall, we had a number of examples where we could demonstrate that we had serious COVID issues and that we didn't kick up a fuss and we got on with playing our games, and that should demonstrate our commitment to fairness. So I think overall, you know, the backdrop was positive for us with the Brentford game, with players missing COVID and us not requesting postponements, which is sort of, it's sort of a good play from Arsenal, because it's only in the last couple of weeks that we've seen these postponements become much more of a part of club strategies versus like a genuine attempt to postpone a game. But I think the biggest thing was our response around Liverpool, because Liverpool really gifted it to us when we had the League Cup game cancelled. And then Klopp came out and the whole false positive conversation came up. And I think that we had two options. And I think at the time we were all surprised as to why we weren't making more of it. Why were we not going and nailing Liverpool and going, come on, this is completely ridiculous. We've just moved a game for one COVID case. But I think the club played a long game. They were really smart. They kept their powder dry and recognised that there might be an opportunity to use it to our advantage. And I think that's what happened, because I think it was going to be such a difficult decision for the FA to say, you can't postpone, but we just postponed a game against you for exactly the same reason. I think that really, really played a part in it. So well played the club. We made it happen.
Yeah, I think that so from what I understand about it is that football fans and journalists, who should really know better, are framing the COVID problem around the idea that it's just a caseload issue. And I thought the same. I was like, well, you know, we've only got one case. There's a few people in the comments saying that actually there was more than one case. But apparently the way that you frame a case to the Premier League, and let's take a moment to celebrate Richard Garlick. From what I understand, when he was at the Premier League, he helped write the rules for training ground protocols. You know, when there's been a COVID outbreak, how do you go back and make sure the players aren't licking each other's faces or whatever it is? So he obviously knew what the rules were. He obviously knows what the Premier League are looking at when they're judging cases. And I think the way that you've got to frame it is COVID is not linear. So you've got the actual cases, which are problematic. Then you've got the players coming back from COVID. And look, we all saw what happened to Gabriel last year when he got COVID. He definitely suffered a bout of long COVID because he didn't come back the same player. Then you've got the players that didn't get COVID, that get overly exposed in games. And all of our players are very young. And then you've got the players with niggly injuries that could turn into big injuries. You've got Tomiyasu that's got, I think he's got problems with his calf. You've got Smith Rowe, who seems to have to come off the bench quite regularly because there's obviously something they're concerned about with him. And I think Arsenal said, look, we can play the Spurs game at the weekend, but if we get two injuries, we have no midfield, we're lacking in defence, we're going to have to cancel the Liverpool game and we'll have to cancel the Burnley game. And I think the Premier League probably said, that's more problematic, because if you move that Liverpool game, then you're in danger of having to move the League Cup final. And I think that they had to give it to us. And I think to your point as well, like when we're talking about maturity and growing up, I think some Arsenal, you know, you always want your club to come out and say, why it was me, have a Mario Balotelli moment and make us feel that you feel victimized as well. But Mikel Arteta has always said, we always want to play. We always want to play the games, which I think worked heavily in our favor. We've kept our powder dry. We could have tried to call off the Man City game, and we didn't. We could have tried to, we could have gone harder at complaining about Liverpool with all of the false positives, and we didn't. And I think the reality of the output is that when we've really needed to cancel the game, we've managed to get it called off. And let's talk about Spurs as well. Spurs being angry in the press.
Are you able to- Yeah. No, we saw that. Someone came and joined me. Yeah, we've seen all the stuff in the press. They're clearly disappointed because I think they recognize that we were there for the taking. I mean, that's the biggest thing, which makes it even more joyful that we're not going to be. I mean, I've seen them bringing up Lasagna Gate some 16 years after the event to try and draw parallels, but.
We've got a pitch invader. We've got a pitch invader with Elsa. Yeah, so I want to, while Matt's addressing his daughter issues at the moment, I do want to talk about some of the bizarre stuff that I see going on in the media. I think Rusty Dog in the comments section said, do you think there's really a media bias? I always think back to technology when you talk about bias, because you've got all of these tech people in Silicon Valley trying to program algorithms that aren't biased. And time again, it's proven that you can't program something. You can't even program a computer to lack bias. So the idea that journalists don't have preferred clubs, that journalists don't have friends at the clubs that they're trying to do a favor for, and that they aren't working for their own agenda is an absolute nonsense to me on so many levels. And I just, you know, Jason Burt really springs to mind because, and Matt's back, Jason Burt really springs to mind because he came out yesterday disgusted that Arsenal had the temerity to try and get a game cancelled because we let Balogun go on loan. Balogun is not a first team player. He needed to go to a level below. And this Jason Burt guy, he seems to cover a lot of United stuff or, you know, just cover stuff up in the north. I went through his tweets. Not one tweet talking about Jurgen Klopp and what he did with the false positives, which was a sporting scandal. It was a sporting scandal, but no one goes after Klopp. You don't go after Klopp because you want access. You want him to answer your question properly when you're doing the games up there. And people that say, no, it's all in the fans' head. It's all in the fans' head. Gary Neville said, I should have spoken up 4 weeks ago. Why didn't you? Because Ralph Rangnick is the Man United manager and you wouldn't speak out against Man United because you want to see your team do well. So the idea that there's all of these Northwestern-based biases that exist in the media, because you literally know they introduced Jamie Carragher as the Liverpool guy. Neville is the United guy. There's not a lot of London love there. So when all of the media went against Arsenal yesterday, all of them, I did think, you know, maybe the Premier League's going to be swayed by it, but they weren't. Arsenal played their hand right. But the idea that Arsenal was somehow victims out of this, when we've not gone to call off a game all season, and then you've got Leicester and Burnley getting cancelled. That's Burnley's fourth game, Leicester's fifth game. Leicester are getting away with AFCON. They're getting away with not having Jamie Vardy in the team. So,
And I think that one of the biggest things is, and we all know this now, is that there's no clear precedent. We don't, like, there's a very, very lax level. You know, it's very much up for interpretation about what the actual rules are. And the reality is, what we should have done is said every game happens however it happens. And if you can only field eight players, you can only field eight players. Because at least there would be clarity around that. The other way of doing it would be to say it's only about COVID positive cases and you have to show a PCR test administered by an independent company. And that's the other way that it matters. But the reality is it's so flexible. There's different rules. It's open to interpretation. And because of that, because sport is all about small percentages, you know. And so if any club can get some type of advantage, then we're going to go for it. And I think that's what we've done. You know, we've spotted the opportunity to gain a competitive advantage. And now you look at it, you go, we've got extra days rest. We don't have to play this high risk game, which is a 6-pointer. Now we can wait till we have our players back. We're going to be all guns blazing on Thursday for Liverpool. We've then got a nice long break and we've completely broken the... It means that we get out of January. We're going to get out of January pretty unscathed. And the danger when we looked at the fixtures was that we could be pretty broken by after the Liverpool second leg. And this has changed that. So I'm absolutely delighted with it.
Yeah, me too. So why don't we move into the Liverpool game? Because we weren't there and I know that a few of you have gone to your other favourite podcasts to get the download, but I do want to talk about that Liverpool game because I wasn't available for a reason. Johnny was away or in Dubai and Matt was not going to host a podcast on his own. So let's just talk about the 10-man Arsenal performance against Liverpool because you are right. A lot of fans from other clubs are like, mate, you didn't even beat Liverpool. You lost to Man City and Arsenal fans are absolutely rejoicing everywhere. But we know that team would have got battered last season. We saw Man United at Old Trafford go down to 10 men and get absolutely shellacked 5-0. Matt, what made that performance special for you? And why is this different? Why are Arsenal fans so happy about this? It was just a draw. It was just a draw.
Look, I think there's a few things. I think over the years that... the best Arsenal teams have always been at their best when their backs are to the wall. You know, you think about us in with George Graham and the brawl at Old Trafford. You think about us when Ruud van Nistelrooy missed the penalty and we all got in their faces. And we've missed that sense of steel that's gone through Arsenal teams. We've lost that resilience. We've become an easy touch. There's been a cultural issue at the club. And what we've all sort of believed is that unfortunately, when it comes to Arsenal, we're great when things go right for us. But the moment things go wrong, we collapse in a heap. It's been just part of our DNA for a while. And opposition fans, they love to point it out. And it's been true. Every time we go down to 10 men, we get thumped. Every time we go up north and play a big game away, we lose. We have a bad moment. Something's unfair. And I think, you know, it really, some of it goes back to really when we moved to the Emirates. I think it goes back to that far. And Arsene Wenger created sort of Project Youth 1.0. But at the time of doing that, we tried to sort of change the narrative. We started talking about net spend. It all felt so unfair because these petrochemical clubs had come in. And really, we'd never stopped behaving like that in a way. And I think Arteta's come in and been trying to change the culture. And there haven't been too many examples of it actually coming to the fore until more recently. But I think it was just such a backs-to-the-wall performance. It was so un-Arsenal-like, but it reminded us of an Arsenal type of team from, you know, many, many years ago. And I think that's the piece. We all expected to crumble. I think at one point I tweeted after Xhaka had been sent off, can we just forfeit and take a 2-0 defeat for some
hope? I saw it, man.
For some hope, you know, and at that moment, if you'd offered me 2-0 defeat, I would have bitten your hand off. I really would, because I thought we were going to get absolutely torn apart. And instead, the organisation, the backs to the wall performance, that looked like a Chelsea performance, not an Arsenal performance. And that was what was so surprising, so shocking, but so brilliant about it.
Yeah, I didn't think we had a hope. And you have to frame that game. That's not Arsenal versus Liverpool at full strength in the Premier League. That's Arsenal with COVID in the squad. That's Arsenal lacking key players. That's Arsenal with their best midfielder, AFCON, at the moment. I won't say that's Arsenal without Aubameyang. That would be unfair. But, you lose Cedric after 11 minutes and you've got to bring on Kyle Chambers. You're really feeling like you're in trouble. Xhaka drops out of the squad, and you know you're back to Rob Holding in another really tough game. And my word, didn't everybody just step up to the plate? And I know I've given Lacazette, you know, a tough time over the last 3 years, but he's been one of the players of the season this year, without doubt. And I know you've got players like Aaron Ramsdale, you've got Odegaard, you've got Saka and Smith Rowe, but Alex Lacazette, just the consistency of leadership that he brings into every game, I never recognised the aggressive side of his game, but he really sets the tone for aggression, hard work. I love that he's holding people accountable. You know, he got goal of the month and he said, this one's for the team after. Like, this is the type of captain that you want, like understated. You know, he does all of the dog's body work for the team. Like, he sacrifices a bit of who he is as a striker, but he just makes his tick. And the more he plays like that, the more you sort of get tempted to think, oh, should we just give him one more year? Should we just give him one more year?
Yeah, I mean, I thought he was fantastic. But I thought, you know what I loved? The fact that as soon as we went down to 10, and I know it's been relatively consistent, we've been suffering from that for a while. But it didn't feel like it was like, oh, what are we going to do now? It was like, okay, we know what we do in these situations. Plan B comes in. We bring Holding off. We bring Nketiah off. We switch to a back five. It happened instantaneously. And in previous years, it felt like we were always underprepared, tactically underprepared. We would just wait. There'd be a moment. We'd be on the back foot. We wouldn't know exactly what we're doing. Whereas now it feels like at the club, we're making plans for different contingencies that mean that give us half a chance. And, you know, that resilience, I think, is a big cultural thing as well. It's not just about players knowing what they're doing or how they're supposed to be behaving. Martinelli did not stop running. And I think the reaction where he dropped to the ground on the full-time whistle just absolutely drained of energy, just showed the amount of effort that that every single player put in terms of concentration, in terms of exertion. And the thing is, you don't keep a clean sheet there if you don't believe you can keep a clean sheet. And I think that every one of those players, whilst we may have had our doubts as fans, every one of those players, even with 10 men, thought, I think they still thought they could win the game. And Saka had a chance, and we could have done a smash and grab and won 1-0. So just so much to be proud of. And by the day, it feels more and more like we're seeing a much more similar thing to what happened when George Graham came in. You know, it's the same type of team, the same type of results, the same type of culture shifts. And I think when Arteta came in, we all were hoping for Arsene Wenger 2.0, like the new Wenger, because he did so much. But it's in the early years. But I think what we're seeing is it's just reminds us all of those George Graham periods of time. And I think a lot of people were drawing parallels with the Spurs League Cup game in 87 that, you know, really represented one of those moments where the team comes of age.
Yeah, it's absolutely fantastic. It's interesting as well, because, you know, we always talk about doing these things in business, and in business, you don't expect to see a complete revamp of a company in 6 months. It takes time. It gets worse. And then finally, things start to click. And if you've done everything right, then you start getting the results. And since the first international break ended, things have just been getting better and better and better. And we're adding new bits every week. Mike McDonald, who writes all of those great scouting reports for Le Grove, he does a really good blog where he does match reviews on gunnerstown.com. He said, you know, we always expect to see players getting better, but you don't expect to see a coach getting better. Nobody really factors that in, that coaches get better. You know, I did think about it. I was like, yeah, you don't expect Mourinho to find the next level in 2 seasons' time or whatever. But, you know, we've hired in an extremely young coach, and he seems to get better every month. And I think, to your point, the in-game management isn't always about what you do in the moment. It's about how you prepare for it. And it really did feel like there was a contingency plan. I mean, you've got to have a contingency plan if Jack is playing against the top two side these days. But it was instant. Everybody knew what they had to do. And, you know, when you've got Martinelli and Saka dropping into midfield and playing, you know, putting in performances like that, it means that everybody sort of understands what everybody else's position is at the moment. And they're of the technical intelligence level now where they can activate against their better instincts, which I just thought was majestic. And one player that I did want to talk about, because maybe we gave him a bit of a hard time for the previous match, the Benny Blanco apology tour from the Arsenal Opinion podcast. Benny's had some ups and downs. It's mostly been ups. I think he's been a brilliant sign-in for Arsenal. But, you know, there's been a bit of kind of in the shadow of Gabriel, because Gabriel embodies everything that English people love in a centre-back. Towering, strong, you know, bit of a bully. And he's been brilliant this season. But Benny Blanco has had a few sort of sketchy moments. He wasn't great against Nottingham Forest. But my word, did he come back with a bang. What did you make of Ben White's performance, Benjamin White's performance, sorry. And how good can he be?
Yeah, we gave him a bit of a tough time, didn't we? Against, I think Johnny especially gave him a bit of a tough time.
Saliba-loving melt.
Yeah, after the game against Forest. And I think there's a few things at play. One was Gabriel was back. And I think it's always much better for Ben White to be playing alongside Gabriel than it is just Rob Holding solo. I think Gabriel really holds a lot together back there. I think he's a young player, so I think there are going to be ups and downs, but I'm more interested in his character, his ability to bounce back from disappointing performances and come back with a performance like that. He looks like a big character. At the end, it's like, that's how we do. That's what he was saying. That's what we do. And, you know, I think...
That's what we fucking do, lads.
it was great to see, wasn't it? The thing about that type of player is they're always going to come in for some criticism, because there's a different, they're not just there for, you know, to be the leader of the thing. He's more like the Carvalho alongside John Terry, or the John Stones alongside Vincent Kompany. You know, like, he's always going to be the second lieutenant, I think. So, you know, we can't expect him to perform all roles. But what he did is he proved that he can also just dig in. He's not just this classy passing midfielder. He's a high quality defender. He's up for the fight. He won't be bullied. And when you combine all those skills with the fact that he's brilliant on the ball, brilliant reader of the game, great offensively, you know, we've just got a real player on our hands. And yeah, he's gonna be up and down. He's gonna make mistakes defensively. He's gonna have to improve on that side of the game. But that's what he can do. And now we just need to see it more and more consistently. But for him to, it's not easy to settle in as an Arsenal centre half. It's a difficult place to play. How many good centre halves have come to us and struggled because of the lack of structure in our team, especially like pre Arteta? I think it's a little bit better now, but it's hard. And he's made the move look very, very easy for someone who's come from Brighton, which, with all due respect, small club compared to Arsenal in terms of the pressure and the microscope that you're under. And he's made it look pretty easy, as have all the players, which says wonders for our talent DNA in terms of character.
I just blocked out there, Matt. I was enjoying your speech on
paper. Yeah, no, I was just saying, like, all of our players have come and bedded in really, really quickly, which, you know, you talk about, you know, Arsene Wenger always used to talk about the character of the player. And I think Arteta is even more laser focused on that. But Ben White's a big character, and he's, you know, there's people already talking about him being a future Arsenal captain. So it's good news.
You know, I love when you listen to the language get spread about a football club, and I love what Ben White said on the pitch. You know, this is how we fucking do it, lads. I love that when Aubameyang got dropped, Ben White was like, yeah, nice guy, but it is what it is. And then they asked him after the game. They were like, Ben, firstly they said, what's it like to play against Liverpool? And he said, it's horrible. Because, you know, they had to concentrate and be relentless the entire game. And they said, you know, what's the difference between this and the Forest game? He said, it is what it is. And it feels like Arteta's always saying it is what it is, because, you know, whatever comes our way, we're going to deal with it. And the reality is, he's a young defender. But I just think back to all the idiots in the summer, all those shitty troll accounts that your dad follows, and the old United get Varane, Liverpool get Konate, and Arsenal get Ben White for 55 million. It's like, who's piping up now? It just goes to show you the masses don't know what they're talking about. And I do think, and I'll speak ill of Johnny while he's not here, but you know, people have got to stop talking about William Saliba now. It's done, man. William Saliba can come back, but he will be deputising for Ben White. The case is closed for me. There were no guarantees that Saliba was going to come back. And if Mikel Arteta says that Ben White is the better defender, you've got to trust him now, because if he knows anything, it's a good defender. And what I love about Ben White as well is the defensive side has been fantastic. You know, like, traditionally, in England, if you're a fancy passing out the back type defender, you're not as good at defending. I feel like Ben White against Liverpool did such a stunning job, like reading the game, leading, fighting to the end. But he's still got that sort of Van Dijk ability to pass. And the one comparison that I thought, you know, I love a defender that likes to keep a clean sheet. And when Liverpool missed that open goal and you've got that picture of him, it felt a little bit like Keown when Ruud van Nistelrooy missed that penalty. You know, like, we finally got a group of players that live for the clean sheet. And interestingly, the Liverpool game, arguably one of Aaron Ramsdale's worst games of the season, and we still kept a clean sheet. I mean, it's been a bit feast or famine sometimes, but overall, we're great at defending. And this is their first year together.
Well, can you believe it that what we thought we were getting in, David Luiz was supposed to be the answer for the guy at the back who can defend and pass and offer something offensively. that was sort of the benchmark in our mind. And then he came into our team. David Luiz isn't all bad. Like he brought some okay things to Arsenal, and I think he tried hard. And I think we'll look back. We don't look back at his time as a failure. It was like it was neither a success nor a failure. It was there were positives and there were negatives. But for someone who was supposed to be good on the ball, good passer, bring much more to the game, he offered zero control. You know, it was Hollywood balls. And a lot, and they were good Hollywood balls. It was the Alex Song of defense. You know, it was just these long launch balls. The free kicks were terrible. His pass completion was nothing to write home about. And I think in Ben White, we've got someone who does everything that David Luiz was supposed to do, but better, whilst offering more security defensively, doesn't have the brain farts, and is 23 years old or whatever it is. So, you know, I think it's just made such a huge difference to have that. And if you think about David Luiz at his pomp, you know, the fact that we've managed to get Ben White, who can do that role for us for the next 10 years for 50 million, I mean, it looks like a bargain.
Yeah. And again, I remember writing that Ben White had got the fan player of the season, and Arsenal fans were saying, no, that was Leeds fans rigging the poll. No, it wasn't. It wasn't. Leeds fans loved him. Brighton fans loved him because he's a great player. And sometimes you have to listen to the views of the fans that watch those players week in, week out. Almost no one in the Premier League recognised that Ben White was an upcoming elite player, apart from Bielsa, Arteta and Potter. So you've got to give credit to the scouting staff that recognize that. And also got to give credit to the Cronkies. You know, they've listened to so many managers over the years say, oh, this player's great. They've invested in him, but you might get a return on Ben White in three seasons' time. That's how good I think he is.
Well, I think that point around the investments is an important one, especially as we go on to talk about transfer window, because it feels for the first time like for so long our metrics of success have been far more holistic. You know, it's been like, it's why we as Arsenal fans are always talking about net spend. We're talking about the balance sheet. We're talking about the commercial revenue. We're talking about all of that stuff. And what I'm pleased is that there's none of that at the moment. It's all about how we're getting better on the pitch. It's far less holistic and more just like, how's the first team delivering? And I think that hopefully we're going to see more and more investment in the team. But across the board, it just seems like we're much more laser focused on how we can drive the team forward.
So let's move on to the next topic. Liverpool on Thursday starts to look a little bit sexy. We've got two games left of this phase now. Burnley on Sunday, Liverpool on Thursday. What are you thinking? Can Arsenal roll Jurgen, Mr. False Positive, on Thursday? Like, we've got to fancy it, right? We've got to fancy ourselves.
I think it's going to be really tough because whatever you may think, I think we wound Liverpool up. They are not going to be happy with how last week went down. They're going to be determined to come back strong and put us to the sword. They're going to think they're a better team than us deep down. And they're going to be determined to shut us up because they were not at their best. They didn't look good. And we had all the laughs on Thursday, but we didn't manage to win the game because of circumstances. So it's going to be really, really tough. I think it's 50-50. I really do. I think that they're a really good team. I think they're going to go all out. But a lot will depend on what players we have available. If we can get Ødegaard and Smith-Rowe fit and back and ready and in the team, and Saka can start and we can have our first choice back five, or at least four of the first choice back five available, then I think that it's all going to come down to personnel.
Yeah, I mean, Ødegaard should have finished his 7 days for COVID tomorrow, so you'd expect him back. Tomiyasu will have had a bit of a rest, so hopefully he's repaired enough to play. Smith Rowe could have been on the bench for tomorrow, I think. And I don't, you know, obviously Xhaka isn't going to be there, so it's going to be very difficult. But you just don't know, because I don't think Liverpool have been particularly impressive. You know, they've been very feast or famine. Spurs walked through them time after time when when they were unlucky not to beat them at home. So I think Liverpool can be got at. I think a little bit of that invincibility aura is wearing off. But the difficulty with Liverpool is, all it takes is a couple of mistakes early on and you're absolutely done for. And you're right, we have wound them up. But home fans are going to be raucous. There'll be a bit of belief in the squad after what happened. And, you give Arteta 7 days on the training pitch, he's going to come up with an interesting plan.
I hope so. I mean,
at least we're in it, right?
Yeah, the game I've got some slight parallels with is the Champions League against Manchester United, when we battled in the first leg and somehow managed to keep them to a draw. And then we all thought, second leg, we got the nil-nil away from home. And now, home advantage, second leg of the Champions League. Let's go and do this. The flags were out, and then Ronaldo scored 2 in the first 10 minutes or something.
Waving our flags.
It was terrible because we thought we had more of the job done than I think we had. We also had a few injuries that night. I think Kieran Gibbs was making his debut or something crazy. But I don't think we can take them for granted. I don't think we will take them for granted. I think that the atmosphere is going to be electric. Let's just hope it works in our favour. There's nothing worse than an electric atmosphere pre-game and then going 1-0 down after 5 minutes. So, yeah, I think it's 50-50. I really do. But that's not bad odds. We'll take it.
That's not bad odds. Okay, so we're going to move into the next section of the show. I have found a new piece of technology on this wonderful tool that we use. I'm going to add some slides.
Ooh!
Everybody
like
getting
it.
Excited about it? You like this? So we're going to talk right now about phase 6 of the season. So when a club plans, they plan in phases and they treat every phase like a mini league. So, phase 1 was up until the international break. Arsenal would have wanted to have come out of that with 4 points and we came out with 0. The second phase, we're trying to get 20 points. So Arsenal are heading into phase 6 of the season, and we've got one more game left of phase 5, and that's now Burnley. So phase 6 of the season, we go into a 17-day break. I think this time last season, Arsenal went to Dubai, and I think Guendouzi had a big fight with Arteta, and that was basically the end of him. I think Pablo Mari bedded in and held up Lucas Torreira like a little toy. So Arsenal have a 17-day break, which is basically like a mini preseason. If we sign, some players, then they get the chance to bed in and learn the ways. But then after that break, phase 6, Wolves at home, which is a rescheduled game from the 27th of December. That's going to be a big game. That's going to be really, really tough because I think Wolves are very underrated. And I think they've got a great manager. They're just a little bit toothless up front. Then we've got Brentford at home. And 9 days later, so a nice big long break. No cup games to worry about. It's just Arsenal and Arteta with the players working towards the next game. Watford away. Leicester at home. And then you've got Villa away on the 19th of March. So you've got 5 games there. Matt, what amount of points do Arsenal need to get out of this phase? What would be acceptable there? Because, we will be right in top 4 mix heading into that game if we beat Burnley. No doubt about it. What would you be expecting to get out of that group of games?
The number of points that we need is really going to depend on the number of points that Spurs get at the same time. And maybe United, because I think we're in a direct shootout with them for 4th. You look at that fixture list. I think there's one important thing to mention. I think there's going to be if we beat Liverpool on Thursday, there's going to be a game sandwiched between Brentford and Watford, which would be the League Cup final. So that would be the additional game for the League Cup, which would make phase 6 extremely spicy. But that's the way we're looking. And I think we could look at 12 points minimum is what we're looking at.
Yeah. I actually think the most difficult game on this list is the Wolves game at home. I think they've got a lot of great players that probably want to shop window themselves for the summer. And, they made United look extremely average at Old Trafford. So I think that would be a really tough game. But I agree. If we can get we can get 12 points out of 13 from that batch of games, which really is a necessity if you want to make top four. We're right in the mix. Okay, so then we shift into the final phase of the season, which you know gets a little bit spicy. So phase seven games. Phase seven is interesting because there's these two extremely huge games just hanging in the air. So we'll have a full strength Spurs side with basically 3 months of extra Conte training, which could be a good or a bad thing, dependent on how well he's doing. And then you've got that Liverpool game. And the Liverpool game is interesting because Liverpool are not in the title race. Jurgen Klopp is under pressure there because, you know, he's bombed the second season. He needs to make an impact on the Champions League. So it could be a good time to play Liverpool. But you look at that run of games that we've got that close out of the season. We've got all of the tricky games that we struggled with in the first half of the season. Brighton battered us. Palace was a really, really difficult game. Man United, we should have won, but you know they shithoused us and managed to come away with a victory. Leeds United is always difficult. Newcastle United, that game at the end of the season could be them staying up or going down. I'm not sure. I'm too worried about Everton, but West Ham, they'll be in the top four race, and then the Premier League are not going to treat those two road fixtures particularly well. Spurs and Liverpool are going to be jammed in at extremely inappropriate times. But the hope that you have as an Arsenal fan is that we don't have any Europe. There's no cup run. So that, you know, I don't want to say there's no excuse because there is an excuse. You've got to, I think Arsenal fans have got to remember this. The target at the start of the season was not top four. That's next season's target. The objective that Arsenal have is within two seasons, they want to be challenging for the Premier League title. So this season, top four is a stretch goal. Like, don't forget, everybody was Arteta out after three games. Everybody thought that he was going to be sacked by November. We can't now be saying, well, the expectation is top four. The stretch goal is top four, and it's going to be really, really difficult. But you look at the run, and then you look at the teams in that run that might have European commitments. And I tell you, you just got to fancy Arsenal. I fancy it, Matt. Am I deluding myself? Like, if we have a good run of, you know, without injuries, am I deluding myself? Or
no, I think top four is absolutely on, and I think the most important letters on all of those fixtures are the H's for home. You know, all those games at home with our home form, I think we can win. I really do, including Liverpool. It's the away ones: Newcastle, West Ham, Southampton. But you know, you look at those games. They're grounds where typically we've been all right at. Maybe not Southampton so well, but...
Didn't have Chelsea in there. We've got Chelsea as to be confirmed as well. Chelsea didn't look good today. And I don't think they're as good as everybody thinks they are. I think we massively overhyped the Champions League win, forgetting that they lost an FA Cup final to Brendan Rodgers, forgetting that they bumbled their way into top four. They look, you know, I think third is up for grabs as well. I'm losing my mind here. Maybe I'm high off of that cancellation.
Look, I think I don't agree that four is a stretch goal now. I think four is the goal now. And I know at the beginning of the season we thought differently, but the reality is we've seen the lay of the land. We've seen the way the season is shaking out. We've seen what teams like United have got to offer this season. You know, we didn't know that at the beginning of the season. We do now. You know, they're a team in disarray. Ronaldo is being a net negative for them. So, you know, we're much more aware of them. Spurs, the results and the performances aren't correlating. They're getting better results in their performances. We know what they're all about. West Ham, we back ourselves over the course of a season. So I really think, based on what we've seen and the potential that we've demonstrated, fourth is the goal. It would still be a great achievement. It's still hard to achieve goals. But I don't think it's a stretch goal. I think fourth is the goal. I think anything less than fourth would feel like a disappointment now, based on the first half of the season. I think one of the things you said all along was, let's get to the beginning of the year, the turn of the year, let's be within 4 points of fourth, and then let's back ourselves to go and make it happen. And we did better than that. We were in fourth at the turn of the year. And so now it's time to finish the job. And I think you look at the fixtures, you look at the performances. Injuries, we're very fortunate to be playing very few games. I said after the dust had settled on the FA Cup that the it was mainly to make myself feel better. But if you don't win it, the best place to go out in the FA Cup is the third round. It just is. You don't want to be getting to the semi-finals of everything.
That was a great tweet, Matt. I love that tweet. It was absolutely spot on.
It was cathartic, wasn't it? It made me feel better. Yeah. So you know, we've got it all to play for. The League Cup will be done in February. A lot of teams around us will be playing in Europe who we're playing against. It's got to be fourth. That's the metric. It doesn't mean that that the season is a failure if we see positive performances, but you know, it's certainly, I see that as the key metric.
And Matt, look at, you know, when you look at these fixtures, so we've got a two week break that's coming up, which should refresh the legs. And then just like, I'll go back to the phase six games, Wolves, on February the 10th, 9 days later, you've got Brentford. Then almost 2 weeks later, you've got Watford. Then it's seven days. Then you get into the April batch of games. Palace, next game is 7 days. The game after that is seven days. You know, it's like 7, 8, 9 day breaks each time. Arsenal have got to make that count, because when you've got the Europa League and you're bumming around, you know, some Norwegian club doing two-legged games, that takes its toll. And I think other clubs are going to, you know, Chelsea are going to be in contention for the, you know, for the Champions League. Liverpool are going to have their minds elsewhere. You know, there's European commitments that these other teams are going to have to deal with that we don't have. Like West Ham are still in Europe. So I don't, it's almost like, you remember the season when Leicester won the Premier League? Leicester won the Premier League because they were out of all of the cup competitions and they just had one thing to focus on every week, and they really made the back half of the season count. Arsenal need to make this back half of the count, because I don't think you're going to get a better chance to get into the top four and invest that money in a proper squad so we can move hard this summer.
Well, we're not. And I think that's why it's so important to get top four, because otherwise, I think theoretically we can all see a plan moving forward, which is we deliver on our potential this season, we get top four, it further builds fan capital and capital with the hierarchy at the club. We make big investments in the summer. And then next season, we're still not challenging for the league, but we're closer to challenging for the league. And then the season after, we can challenge for the league. That's, I think a lot of people at the club see it that way, which means that not next season, but the season after, we're challenging. And I think that could also combine with, I don't think Conte will be there. I don't think Tuchel will be there. I don't think Pep Guardiola will be there. I don't know if Klopp will be there. I think it could be a new generation of managers in the Premier League just based on cycles. So it could leave us with a great opportunity. If we don't get top four, that plan drops back a year. It just everything slides back a year, and there's momentum lost, because, you know, you talk about being the most exciting project in world football, but we also need to demonstrate, the fact that we don't have Champions League football makes it harder to sell Arsenal to top players, top young players who have more options. Think how much easier it would be to sign Vlahovic now if we could say, we want you because we've got Champions League group games coming up, and you know, that's where we're headed. Instead, we're like, yeah, we're saying all the right things, but we're not even in the Europa Conference because, you know, we've had a terrible few years. It's a harder sell. So we have to make it happen. We have to get top four. And for years now, we've been plotting these sort of paths. If this happens and that happens, but we haven't done it. So we just got to make it happen by hook or by crook. And what I like about Arteta and the noises in the transfer window is he knows that. I think everyone at the club knows it. We're never going to have a better chance than this season. It's us versus Spurs versus United in a straight shootout. Let's just go and make it happen.
So we'll close out the show on some transfer chatter. The Dusan Vlahovic seems to be the number one target. You've got Fiorentina's owner holding out for 58 million, which I think is batshit crazy considering the player's only got 18 months left to go on his deal. You've got the owner of Fiorentina saying that his agent wanted 8 million just for his client to sign back on. For his current club, It seems that Arteta thinks that we don't talk to players that aren't interested because everybody's interested. So what do you think is going to go on with Vlahovic? Surely we can't go into the rest of the season without a new striker. Do you think that this is smoke, or do you think that there's some serious fire coming in here and we might be welcoming an elite striker? What do you think?
I think if you ask me, do I expect Vlahovic to come in January? I'd still say no. I feel like it definitely, you know, talking about stretch goals, that feels like a stretch goal. Just a few too many obstacles standing in the way. And it feels like a very un-Arsenal thing to do. You know, break the bank in January and get the target that everyone is talking about. That's just not what we do. That's what Chelsea do. That's what Man City do. They go and make it happen. We don't do that.
We do. We did it with Aubameyang.
Yeah,
we
did, but that felt like, it felt weird that there weren't more clubs in for him at the time, and it happened pretty quickly. This one is like full on drawn out process. We feel like we've been here a million times as Arsenal fans. However, there's definitely something going on. I like the noise from Fiorentina suggests that there's a deal to be done. So you know, who knows? But what I do know is, it would bolster us so much to feel like to bring him in. And I think just the advantages of having 6 months to bed in before next season would be phenomenal. I just think it would be brilliant. So I'm not positive, but I am hopeful. And I think if we manage to pull it off, then, you know, and Arteta and the crew have given him the thumbs up, then we're rolling, you know?
Yeah. And here's the reality of the deal. And like, I'm not speaking from insider trading. I'm just speaking of somebody that's nerded out on transfers for the best part of 20 years. But it seems like it's a market of one. Nobody else is in for Vlahovic. There's nobody better than us that needs a striker at the moment. And there's no one worse than Arsenal that has any money. That's why the Spurs thing isn't on the agenda. That's why Conte's sulking at the moment. Spurs don't have any money. The only club that could potentially have money is Arsenal, and that's because KSC will put their hand in their pocket if they see an opportunity to sign a player. So there's only one club in. Fiorentina don't have any leverage because once he's got 12 months on his deal, which is, you know, that's the case that, you know, in June, his value drops again. Then you go from being able to potentially get 55 million to maybe only 40. And the player is looking to get more people interested in so he can drive his price up. But there's just simply no way Arsenal are going to pay 300,000 a week to a 21-year-old when we've got the current best, you know, 20, 21 and 19-year-old in world football. So I think there's a deal to be done. And I think if Vlahovic wants to play for one of the mega clubs at some point, there's no better place that you're going to get coached. There's no club that you're going to get more minutes in at the moment. And there's no project that feels like it could bang in a couple of years more than Arsenal at the moment. Like, everybody else is in different phases of their cycle. So I'm with you. It feels a little bit too fantasy football at the moment, but there's definitely something going on because Fiorentina need to shift the player. And if the player wants to move up and, you know, make those extra 6 months worth of salary, I don't think there's a better option in world football for him at the moment. So we'll watch this space. Arthur Melo is another player that we're being linked to on loan. Had a rough time at Barcelona, been done for drink driving in the past, regularly caught out at Neymar parties. Is it Juve? Juve don't seem to want him. I mean, there's talk that Allegri has vetoed the deal. When you read about Melo being a player that doesn't like to pass it forward at Barcelona and he wasn't the Javi that they thought he was going to be, do you wonder about this loan signing, or would you just say, look, a body is a body at this point? And, you know, if he's technically gifted enough to get to Barcelona, he's probably technically gifted enough to get into our midfield at the moment. What do you think?
I don't know enough. I haven't watched the player, to be honest, that much beyond highlight reels and the odd game I've seen where he's been playing, and I haven't really noticed him, to be honest. So I don't feel that. I don't know. A lot of it's based on reputation, I think. What I like is that his career is stalled, but he's clearly of the highest quality to be able to be, you know, wanted by Barcelona and Juventus. So hopefully the club look at it and go, he's got something to prove, and we're his last chance saloon. Because I think that's always a good place to be in Arsene Wenger traded in that with Vieira and Henri and Bergkamp a lot. You know, he'd pick up players who weren't
even
having
Perez.
And Perez picked up players who weren't having their best moments, but were high quality, and put them in a team. And I think there's something about I was looking at reading something about high performance, and if you really want high performance, then put people. There's a statistic that if you put people within 20 feet of other people who are high performers, it lifts their performance. And I think coming into a young Arsenal team where everyone's working hard and has a shared common vision and is aggressively pursuing it, you know, we could see the best of him. So that's just based on the psychological side of it. And I think if, you know, Arteta and Edu have given themselves breathing room to make these types of decisions, alone obviously is no risk. So get him in. Let's get him in and let's see. It seems more likely, especially if we're going to go and spend all this money on a striker, to go and do a deal like this rather than sign. There's the Bruno Guimarães guy. I think that's how you say the surname.
That everybody loves.
But, you know, it seems like there's a deal to be done there as well. Loan to buy, people are talking about. So, but yeah, Melo and Vlahovic would do very nicely. I could see them teaming up for a winner at Shite Hart Lane in a month's time.
Yeah, I love the point. So it's, you know, sometimes you have to look in places that other people aren't looking at. Like if your name is Arthur Melo and you get a move to Barcelona and you're a Brazilian international, there's something in there. And when you're 25 years old, you can be saved if you're committed to the cause and you've realized the error of your ways, because nobody wants to be bumming around in no man's land as a footballer. So, you know, and Arsene Wenger used to do it very successfully. The final question of the podcast, a few people asking about this in the comments section. Jack Noshire, wouldn't the easiest deal to be done, sign the ex-Arsenal legend that's training with you, he hasn't had an injury, you're really impressed with him, wouldn't Jack Wilshere just slip right into that lineup? Why hasn't Arteta signed Jack Wilshere? You know, he's been on a great PR run lately. What's going on there?
Look, I think Arteta has shown himself to be very astute about making the decisions that can get him what he wants long term in his squad. And I think that bringing Jack Wilshere back is a very Arsene Wenger move. It's an internal solution. It's a pragmatic way of dealing with a problem that makes a lot of sense for the club. It's low cost. It's low risk, low cost, all upside. Makes a lot of sense when you're thinking about the role, the club, and the sort of more holistically. But for Arteta, he's much more from like the Mourinho school, where he, at the moment, his priority seems to be to highlight to his bosses the deficiencies that exist within the squad, so that they go out and invest in the players that he wants long term. So I think he looks at this and just goes, if I bring this guy in, it's another reason for the club to say, oh, well, actually, you got Jack Wilshere. I mean, he's doing a good job. He's come in and played well. So I feel like there's the opportunity to... He needs to plead poverty at the moment, Arteta, in the hope of...
he's creating the poverty as well by kicking all these players out, which I do love.
Yeah, I mean, everyone was saying, you know, what about, you haven't got any midfield, but Torreira, Guendouzi and Maitland-Niles are all on loan. But, you know, if he gets what he wants, if he brings in the midfielder, if he brings in the striker, then hats off. You know, he's worked the system.
And Marseille have got a 2 transfer window ban coming in. So it'll be interesting to see whether they can still buy Guendouzi at the end of the season, or whether that means that Matteo is coming back to Arsenal. I know he's been a good player there this year, even though he's an absolute shit. So, okay, Matt. All right. Well, thank you for giving me 1 hour and 5 minutes of your time. Matt, where can people find you on Twitter? Because you've been on fire with the tweets this week, and I think people need to hear them.
I'm at Matt Candela. Give me a follow. Feel, like I said, so excited about Arsenal at the moment. I think someone commented, when Arsenal are on fire, it feels like every other day they're not playing is just a day you're waiting for them to play again. And that's certainly the way it feels like. I'm grateful that the game's being postponed tomorrow. I think it's the right thing. But, you know, we were all looking forward to tuning in for the big North London derby. But now, you know, all attention to Thursday. I'm going to be resting up. You know, I'm already excited about that. And we'll be on the whistle on Thursday.
Fantastic. Yeah. And Johnny will be back. I think he's in Dubai at the moment, trying to get to the bottom of what William was doing there this time last year. So I'm sure he'll give us the full report then. If you're listening to this on iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, say something nice. You know, it means the world to us. And if you've been in the comments section today, playing along and asking questions, we truly appreciate you joining us live. It makes it so much fun. So on that note, we'll say ciao for now.
Ciao for now.
Peacock streaming, the biggest live events from Super Bowl 56 to complete coverage of the Winter Olympics. It's all the unbelievable sports to love. Sign up now at peacocktv.com.
Sports Social Podcast Network.